This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held October 31st, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The open session of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, October 31st, Halloween 2013, will now come to order. Happy Halloween, everyone. I want to particularly compliment Commissioner Hunter on her festive Halloween jewelry. I admit I was looking for something Halloween-y at home, but couldn't find it. I think this is partially because my daughters have left home and taken their skull jewelry with them. But we do have candy out in the lobby, and I encourage everybody when they leave to pick up a piece of candy on the way. So happy Halloween, and I also want to give a shout out as a former Bostonian to the world champion Boston Red Sox. Go Sox! Yoo-hoo! Thank you, Kathy. I knew you'd like that. Got everybody's a Sox fan today, so that's great news. I also want to thank all of the staff. This is the first meeting that we've had since the shutdown and then reopening, and I know that was stressful and difficult for all of the staff, and everyone came back with a lot of energy and enthusiasm, really happy to get back to work. And I particularly appreciate, and I know I speak on behalf of all of my colleagues, all of the enthusiasm and dedication that our staff brings every single day. So I really want to publicly and personally thank you all for that. And if that wasn't excitement enough, we have six commissioners at the table for the first time in a very long time. We have brand new commissioners. I want to, again, on behalf of all my colleagues, welcome Commissioners Lee Goodman and Ann Ravel. We are so happy to have you with us. I'm so personally delighted that the president chose two individuals with such great experience, and I know you're all both going to bring so much good thoughts and good energy to the commission. We had a nice internal reception a couple of days ago, and the staff were all really delighted, and I think it really improved morale for them to have the opportunity to meet you, and I know they're all looking forward to working with you, as are we. So this is a really exciting day at the FEC. Would anybody like to make any comments?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair Weintraub. I am really happy to be here, really honored to be here, especially with such great commissioners. I'm glad to be a part of this group. And I also had an opportunity to meet a lot of the staff. Although I don't remember all your names, but it is clear that they are dedicated public servants and care about the mission of the FEC. So it's, as I said, it's wonderful to be here, and I look forward to achieving consensus with all of you. Thank you.
Commissioner Goodman?
Well, thank you, Chairman Weintraub, and welcome, Ann. It was my honor to be nominated and appointed by President Obama and recommended to the President by Senator McConnell, both men whom I admire personally very much. It is also an honor to serve with such a distinguished group of commissioners, and I look forward to working with all of you. When you begin on a job like this, I guess it bears observation. You start taking stock of the place you're joining and the task ahead. And I can tell you, in my transition here, I've had to think through what a complicated agency this really is. We're asked to balance on a daily basis First Amendment rights, profound First Amendment rights, with the common sense regulation of politics to avoid corruption in the system. In a context where the law is evolving and changing, you know, every 6 months. And I look forward to undertaking that task. It's also complicated because, unlike other agencies, where a prevailing election creates a clear direction and majority, we were constituted on a bipartisan basis, and we were asked to try to reach consensus on these difficult issues. And so the task ahead is complicated, but I think with open and engaged reason exchange, we may find some consensus. And I look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to try to do that. I also want to say that in my first week here, I also have become acquainted with a lot of very committed and competent and dedicated staff here at the FEC. And, you know, despite the agency being a complicated place, you can see that there are some people here who have worked here for 20, even 30 years. And I just want to say thank you for making me feel welcome. Thank you. I've been on-ramped into a few jobs in my day, and I don't think I've ever been on-ramped into a new position as graciously as I have here. And I just want to thank the staff and tell you all that I look forward to working with you as colleagues. Thank you.
Great. First item on our agenda is correction and approval of the minutes. Commissioner Peterson, do we have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of minutes for September 12, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-42.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson has moved approval of the minutes for September 12, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-42. Is there any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Is it appropriate to...
Commissioner Ravel?
Is it appropriate to vote on the minutes if we were not present?
It's entirely up to you. Some commissioners have, some commissioners haven't. If you choose to, you may abstain from the vote.
No, I'm happy to vote for it. Thank you.
So I believe the motion passes 6-0. I like the sound of that. The next item on the agenda is election of a new vice chairman. With Commissioner McGann's departure, the position of vice chairman was left vacant, and we appreciate Commissioner Peterson stepping into the void there for a while. But we do need to have an official election, an official vice chairman. So is there a nomination? Commissioner Ravel.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It is my privilege to nominate Lee Goodman to serve as vice chair of the commission for the remainder of 2013. Commissioner Goodman comes to the FEC with a wealth of campaign finance, election administration, and ethics experience. He most recently was a partner with the LeClaire Ryan Law Firm and previously was counsel at Wiley Ryan, where he advised corporations, media entities, nonprofit organizations, trade associations, political parties, campaigns, and politicians on compliance with federal and state campaign finance laws. He also has served in many levels of politics. He was legal counsel and policy advisor to the governor of Virginia, counsel to the Attorney General of Virginia, Special Assistant Attorney General of Virginia, and Chief Advisor to the Chairman of the Congressional Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce. Commissioner Goodman also served as General Counsel for the Republican Party of Virginia for the past 6 years and worked on various political campaigns. Because of this diverse background and experience, I know he will bring unique perspective to the matters before the commission. And I have been fortunate myself to spend some time with Commissioner Goodman, and there is no doubt that he will serve as vice chair with distinction, honor, and integrity. And I look forward to working with him very closely in this role. Accordingly, I would like to make the motion to nominate Lee Goodman to be vice chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Ravel has moved Commissioner Goodman's nomination to be vice chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Is there any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Did you vote for yourself or not?
I did not.
Okay. The motion passes 5-0. Just wanted to make sure. And congratulations, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you.
Welcome.
And thank you, Commissioner Ravel.
The next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-11. We do have a late submitted document. Commissioner Peterson, do you want to do the honors?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 13-41, which is the draft advisory opinion 2013-11 in the matter concerning Citizens for Jill Miller.
Thank you. Commissioner Peterson has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 13-41. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Another unanimous motion, 6-0. Ms. Hemsley, would you like to start us off?
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Commissioners, good morning to you and welcome. Agenda document 13-41 is a draft advisory opinion requested by Citizens for Jill Miller asking whether it may use campaign funds to post a cash deposit in lieu of a supersedious bond on appeal from an Alaska court judgment against former Senate candidate Joseph Miller and or to pay the final judgment should Mr. Miller be unsuccessful on his appeal. The draft concludes that the committee may use campaign funds for these purposes because neither the lawsuit nor the judgment would have existed irrespective of Mr. Miller's campaign. We received two comments on the request. We received two comments on the draft, and we would request authority to make any technical and conforming amendments if necessary. Madam Chair, thank you. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And I understand we have Mr. Olson in the audience. Please come sit at the table. I have a feeling we're going to have some questions for you.
Madam Chair,
yes,
is it appropriate for me to ask a question of counsel?
It certainly is. I was just about to ask whether anyone had any questions of our counsel or Mr. Olson. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I have a question on the test for personal use. Is the test for personal use campaign relatedness, or is it whether or not somebody ultimately prevails on the merits of a lawsuit?
Mr. Noti?
The general test, well, there are certain things that are per se personal uses under the statute and the regulations. Once we're outside that category, the test is expenses that would not have arisen irrespective of the candidacy. In the context of litigation specifically, in prior matters, the Commission has used language to the effect of campaign-related, but I don't believe that the Commission has ever focused on whether it's a judgment versus an expense of the litigation.
Okay. But may I continue? Whether or not a lawsuit begins during candidacy and the candidate wins or loses, has the Commission ever said that winning or losing the lawsuit determines whether it is personal use or not?
No. The only way in which I'm aware of that winning or losing matters is if a candidate uses campaign funds to fund litigation and wins, they can't then keep the money that they win if it's for financial gain.
Mm-hmm. Has the Commission ever opined that a candidate can pay a judgment in a lawsuit that was campaign related?
I don't believe that's been presented to the Commission, but I'm not positive.
Okay. But just to be clear, winning or losing has never been the touchstone?
No, it has not.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions, comments?
I'll let you know.
No? Commissioner
Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In order to break the silence, at least get the ball rolling here. I don't know if this will goose things at all, but I'll stay where I am on this matter. But I support the draft that's before us now. I think it's a fairly straightforward personal use question. The litigation at issue arose when several newspapers sought Mr. Miller's employment records and from when he worked in local government, and they claimed that they needed them because they were entitled to the records because of Mr. Miller's status as a Senate candidate. And then the trial court, when it issued its order stating that the records should be turned over, it based its holding on the fact that Mr. Miller's normal right to privacy with respect to those documents was not applicable in this particular instance because, and precisely because, he was a high-profile Senate candidate. And then subsequently, when Mr. Miller intervened in the case in order to protect his own privacy rights, as well as filing cross-claims and third-party claims, all of those arose out of the initial dispute. So clearly, Mr. Miller's expenses related to this litigation would not have existed, irrespective of his Senate candidacy. And for that reason, and that is the test: is would they have arisen irrespective? We don't really, as the questioning by the vice chairman pointed out, we don't really look at how these things prevail. If we did so, I think we would be going down a road that could have some problems. So I believe that these expenses may be paid for with campaign funds, and for that reason I plan to support the draft that is currently before the commission.
Commissioner Walzer?
It kind of depends on where we're going to go in the discussion. One of the concerns, a concern that I have is that I'm presently not inclined to support the draft is the fact that of the order, or in the order regarding the fees, the court has found that about $73,000 was based upon an enhanced fee that the court decided to impose because of a bad faith, a whole litany of things that constituted conduct on the part of Mr. Miller. And I think there's a number of questions that can come arise out of that. But at this point, what we're being asked to do is pay for both sides of the litigation. I mean, certainly Mr. Miller and his campaign committee, and I'm not too sure what did they really charge, was the fee really $10,000 a month, as the interrogatory seemed to indicate, or was it a contingent fee, or perhaps you could enlighten us a little bit on that. It's a little bit peripheral to the merits, but it is of interest to me in terms of how we land on this.
Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Commissioner. Bill Olson, representing Citizens for Joe Miller. As to your specific question, the fees that he was paying his own attorney were on a contingent basis, so that there were allegations by a commenter that had no idea what the arrangement was, speculated, and the prior payments during an earlier period were disclosed, certainly, and after that it became a contingency. So that is not the issue, of course, as to this money, because this has to do with attorney's fees to the Alaska Dispatch, which is a magazine blog that strongly opposes candidate Miller's candidacy in 2010 and ongoing candidacy because he's a candidate again in 2014. And so the one thing I'd want to add as a factual matter to your comment about the enhancement on the attorney's fees, and it's specified actually in the draft advisory opinion. One of the factors was, in terms of the enhancement, was that he was a candidate for Senate and there was a public interest involved. So it seems to me that is, I'm cautioned, I guess, not to argue these. I've never been through this before, so forgive me if I don't know exactly what the rules are, but I think that enhancement actually quite clearly demonstrates the campaign relatedness of the expenditure.
Just to clarify then, the answers to interrogatories said that over a fairly extended period of time that there was a $10,000 a month fee. I just wanted to get it clear. And that continued after the post-disclosure order, I gather, or not? Because there's a third-party complaint that was filed against the mayor, and at that point, were those issues based upon a contingency fee relationship?
Yes.
Okay. So if that were the case, then would that be on behalf of the campaign or on behalf of him personally?
Well, in order, when the integrity of a candidate is challenged, in this particular sense, it had to do with his personnel records as an employee of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. He was, as an individual, the person who was considered an indispensable party by the papers that had brought the suit, and then he had the, in order to defend his privacy rights, he had to intervene as an individual. It's you know, obviously in his capacity as a candidate that the intervention was made, but it's in his own personal name.
Well, I saw that he intervened as an individual in claiming the real party in interest was him. And then later on, there was a contention that he contended he wasn't really a defendant in the case. And I wanted to get a little bit of clarity of when he was acting in his personal capacity and when he was acting really as part of the campaign. If he were then pursuing a litigation for a personal wrong, and the proceeds of that were awarded to him, just say in general, say a large amount of money, that would be money available to him for his personal use, I assume.
No, actually, the record is to the contrary, and that's unequivocal that the $5,000 that was awarded to him was paid to the lawyer as part of the attorney's fees. It had absolutely no benefit to Mr. Miller. And as to the question of when someone is a candidate or has his candidate hat on or personal hat on, you know, going back to the test that the commission has explained in terms of the expense would not have existed irrespective of the candidacy. Here, you've actually got language in the complaint, which again is referenced in the draft AO, that says the reason we want these documents is he is a candidate and the people have a right to know, despite the fact that there was a Fairbanks ordinance precluding the dissemination of the information that were leaked by the mayor and others, apparently.
Well, I was just trying to get clarity on when he was really acting in his personal capacity to obtain the benefit of a judgment, monetary judgment, where those funds would not be part of the campaign, but they would be part of his personal use. But let me go on a little bit on the issue that's of concern to me, and that is we're being asked to approve the use of campaign funds for an award of attorney's fees by the other side. Not usually. We're usually being asked to talk about whether it's okay to use campaign funds for the candidate, but this is really for the opposing party, where the attorney's fees are being awarded in theory. And the way I calculated out is that the total fee was roughly $112,000. What is that, rough? $112,375,000. Of that, he's being asked to pay $84,281.25, which is 75%. But 65% of the total fee is being enhanced. It was enhanced by 65%, so that because of what the judge contended was wrongful conduct throughout that phase of the litigation, it was basically $73,043.75. That particular amount is 65% of the award. And the reason I'm concerned about it is whether or not we should be considering money that has been charged against a candidate, whether personally or as counsel, for conduct that the court clearly has delineated in there as bad faith, a number of deceptions, delays, inaccurate information given to the court, lack of information given when required to be given. All of those are in there, and that's the fee that has been enhanced. So should we really be, as a matter of policy, permitting campaign funds to be used to pay a fee based upon that conduct? And if, in fact, that fee gets upheld, that's what would be occurring. So I'm concerned with the public policy of trying to, you know, put the irrespective test in there, because I don't think that intentional conduct or wrongful conduct of that kind really necessarily fits in the irrespective rubric. That's my concern.
Mr. Olson.
If there's a question that I can respond to at the end of that.
From all that, I assume you've got some answers to provide. That's just trying to explain to me my concern.
Yes. I mean, really a close examination of the legal fees that were encountered by the Alaska Dispatch attorney is worth doing if that's the direction you're headed, because even after the award of they were considered the prevailing party because they were allowed to have certain documents from his private personnel records before the election, and that was what the ultimate award was based on. But it was over a period of more than a year and a half that the Alaska Dispatch, which was not ever sued by Joseph Miller, it was the part they sued his employer, the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The employer said that we can't give this out without a release. We don't have a release. They said Joseph Miller was an indispensable party. He intervened in the case. The court put the whole case together. And one of the lessons that all of us know about litigation is that once you start something, it's very difficult to have it stop, because all the other media outlets dropped out except for the Alaska Dispatch, which has a political agenda. I think it's the documents will reflect. And if you go to their website, on the bottom right-hand corner, it says Joseph Miller Project, which doesn't sound like something you'd find on the Washington Post. So you've got a political organization involved in a political agenda that simply sent reporters to the lawyer attending discovery and depositions and such, and racking up very substantial funds. There's no, this is an extraordinary thing. As a matter of fact, there's another provision of Alaska law that indicates that if you have a judgment and there's no money involved, that the attorney's fees you can recover is 20% of your attorney's fees. So complete a provision of law that was not recognized in this order. It's up on appeal. It's going to be resolved. But the issue of trying to impute bad faith, if we're going to impute bad faith, the position we would say is look very carefully at the hours expended. Over a 17-month period, the Alaska Dispatch did not even make one important filing in the case. And yet they stayed in the case because they said in a radio interview, and that's in our statement, that we are afraid that he is going to be a candidate again. And we don't want him having access to videotapes of depositions. Well, their motive was purely political. He was a candidate. And when someone takes their hat off as a candidate in this situation, I don't think he does.
The
Commissioner Wolf.
And other people may have some questions, so I'll just head off this. But in the order, let's get back to the actual litigation, because we're talking about a fee that's been awarded based upon specific criteria here. And if you go through the list of here, like the judge says, where a losing party acts in bad faith in asserting a claim or defense, it is appropriate for the court to enhance fees. The court enhanced the fees by $73,000. And then it lists a whole number of things. Miller's conduct, which included taking inconsistent positions, failing to disclose information during discovery, being unavailable for his deposition, and the procedural filings which the record did not support, all caused unnecessary delay and cost for both Alaska Dispatch and Borough. So aside from motivations, you have a court's binding state court judgment that's hard for me to overlook at this stage, because you basically seem to me to be kind of gambling with that. I mean, when I say you, I don't... But it seems to be proposing a use of campaign funds to gamble on the outcome of this case.
Again, the problem is once you get in litigation, it's hard to get out. And they tried to get the Alaska Dispatch out just like the other media outlets, and they refused because they had a different political agenda.
Well, wasn't that a reason that they wanted to get their attorney's fees? I mean, certainly you don't have to blame somebody who wants to see the end of a case because to be vindicated, and they were vindicated.
If you rack up another $50,000 because you want attorney's fees, well, they certainly racked up the time. Mm-hmm. But they were not active participants. They were never even sued by Miller.
I appreciate your responses, and I
thank you.
Let me see if I can try to put perhaps a fine point on a subset of the issues that Commissioner Walther raised, because I think, as a general matter, the litigation was campaign-related, clearly was related to his status as a candidate, would not have existed irrespective of that. But I do think that Commissioner Walther raises an interesting point about the award of the attorney's fees and how the fee schedule was varied based on what the court described as vexatious or bad faith conduct. And I welcome your help on this, because I've read the order, but I'm not sure that I'm really 100% in the weeds on all the facts of this, and you undoubtedly know this better than I do. Because just reading the order, it sounds like the order was that Mr. Miller was ordered to pay more fees because the court believed that he did not behave appropriately as a litigant, that he engaged in bad faith and was not playing fair in discovery and was engaged in a number of areas of conduct that the court saw fit to enhance the fee on account of. Am I reading that right, or is there something else? I hear what you're saying about how, you know, it was all politically motivated. I get that. But was there am I not reading this order correctly? Were there other things going on about Mr. Miller's conduct in this litigation that I'm missing here? And I'll just tell you up front that I think he's entitled to appeal this, obviously, and I would be in favor of saying he's allowed to use campaign funds for that appeal. But if at the end of the day he ends up with an order that says you have to pay more because not because you were defending the litigation or because you were contesting whether your personnel record should have been disclosed or not, but because as a litigant you didn't play fair, and the court kind of lost its patience with him. That, to me, seems like perhaps that does veer into personal conduct. He may have been drawn into this litigation as an indispensable party, but once he got there, how he conducted himself in that litigation was up to him. And people are allowed to be vigorous advocates on their own behalf, but this sounds like maybe he may have crossed the line, at least in the opinion of this judge. So I want to give you an opportunity to correct the record if you think I'm reading this wrong or if there are other facts that you want to tell me about that.
Well, there's no question that this order and this award of attorney's fees came as a complete shock to everyone. The appeal will determine, but in violation of many aspects of Alaska law and law and attorney's fees, and I think some of this will shake out as the case proceeds. So looking at this as a snapshot, I mean, we were, in essence, required by the Alaska Dispatch to come in and seek the advisory opinion because they were challenging the posting of the supersedious bond. And so we've gone ahead and done that presented the case as it is because there is no appellate resolution by the Alaska Supreme Court as of this point. So it is, I can understand the chair's distinction between the legitimacy of the posting of the supersedious bond, the defense of his rights and such, and something that may occur down the road. I understand that point, but you have to look at all the aspects of what laid the foundation for the claim for attorney's fees, not just the rhetoric in the order, because the basis of the attorney's fees was hundreds of hours of legal fees that never had to be incurred to attend depositions which they were not involved with. If you have a lawyer who just shows up at everything and starts billing, you have a real problem. You have an uncontrolled expense, and no one expected that those expenses would ever be. This is, in a sense, the lawyer might have been showing up as a reporter for all we know to be able to be present at those depositions, but the unnecessary nature of all of those expenses and how they all of a sudden got sprung in the order came as a great surprise to everyone. And now we just have to deal with the situation the way it is. But we believe that there was a very clear motive for those expenses and why they were run up.
Well, I understand that, and I don't think that we can get into parsing whether the attorney's fees were appropriate or not. My concern is more to if at the end of the day, and as I said, I'm in favor of allowing the use of campaign funds for the supersedious bond and to appeal this, because maybe at the end of the appeal the facts will look very different. I don't know. I don't know what happened. And we're not being asked to rule on that. But I could envision a circumstance where, based on what's in this order, if at the end of the day he's being ordered to pay more, because not because he was embroiled in litigation, not because his reputation became at issue in the campaign, not because personnel records were released and their release was contested, or any of those facts, but because in the course of contesting all that, in the court's view, his conduct was not appropriate for a litigant. Again, I think that may cross the line into a personal use that is not. He wasn't required to behave in that way in order to be embroiled in the litigation. Now, the issue might go away at the end of the day, but I guess where that leaves me is, while I'm comfortable with saying that it's appropriate for him to pay the supersedious bond, the cost of appealing, I'm not sure that today, based on the facts that are in front of me, that I would be willing to say, and whatever judgment results, whatever the basis of that judgment is, it would also be appropriate for him to use campaign funds for that. It might be, and, at the end of the day, if we end up with an opinion that says, you're going to have to, we're holding in reserve the issue of whether the ultimate judgment can be paid with campaign funds, but, you're welcome to come back and ask that question at the end of the day so that we'll know what the judgment is for. And at that point, we may well say that's fine. But I'm just not sure that I can say that today, because I don't know what the judgment is going to be based on the issue of his personal conduct has been raised in this order. I'll give you a chance to respond to that if you want to, and then I'll turn to Commissioner Walther.
Well, I would just be cautious about a rule that would make it difficult for a litigant to be able to, who's a candidate, a member of Congress, or a candidate for office, to be able to engage in the active defense of his rights in a case. Now, I understand what you're citing but if we begin to second-guess trial strategies and such, it might be a very difficult job for the commission. That would be my suggestion.
Fair point. Commissioner Walther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only issue that I'd raise is from your comment was that the supersedious bond precisely is a cash bond. And if they lose, that money is no longer available except to pay the judgment. So if we agree that campaign funds can be used for a supersedious bond, cash money, then there's no discretion is left on our part.
But is there any way for him to appeal without posting the supersedious bond?
No.
That's a problem. Because I think he's got the right to appeal. And so it may turn out, I think what Commissioner Walther is suggesting is it may turn out to be a moot point. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Yes. It's clear to me that the lawsuit was visited upon Mr. Miller because of his candidacy. And you've submitted copious materials to indicate that. It happened during his candidacy. It related to embarrassing him as a candidate. And he did intervene as an indispensable party to the lawsuit. And to me, that passes the irrespective test. The judgment is for litigation costs that were incurred in that lawsuit derived from his campaign. And that makes it not personal. That makes it campaign-related. As you mentioned, the enhancement also was, to some extent, candidate-related. I'm afraid that if we extend the test, the irrespective test, to state a new rule, that vexatious or bad faith conduct in a litigation somehow changes the nature of the expenditure, we go far beyond the irrespective of candidacy test. Otherwise, the test becomes winning or losing a litigation. Otherwise, the test becomes a state judge's temperament. It becomes fighting too hard in a litigation. It becomes varying state laws that award attorney fees in any number of circumstances. It becomes varying state law standards for awards of fees. And sitting where we sit, I believe we have to make a judgment of whether or not the genesis of this lawsuit and the subject of the lawsuit was candidate-related, and whether the lawsuit was visited upon Mr. Miller irrespective of candidacy. And so I'm prepared to support the draft advisory opinion prepared by our Office of General Counsel.
Ms. Donder.
Well put, Mr. Vice Chair. I agree with what my colleagues over here have said, and I do think it's dangerous to start splitting hairs with how somebody defends a lawsuit. I mean, we know here at the FEC we've paid attorneys' fees before. We've fought turning over documents, and that's within our right to do so. You know, there's been many times where we've asked to protect documents from the public in litigation. And so I would hate to parse how somebody's doing something. And an example that came to my mind is a few years ago we had a question about whether or not somebody could install a security system in their home and whether that would be considered personal use, and we said it would not. And I wonder if we then said, well, gee, that guy needed a security system because he was kind of a jerk. And he ran around, you know, bullying people and told them that they, you know, if they didn't vote for him, he was going to egg their house on Halloween. And so we didn't do that. And I think that's sort of analogous here. If we start getting into how does somebody conduct themselves in litigation, that it seems most of us or all of us agree was completely related to his candidacy, then it's a very dangerous, slippery slope. Thank you.
Commissioner Walton.
Did you have something to say?
Just one brief response on that. In this particular case, though, it's framed precisely because if the order is upheld, it will be specifically because, to the degree of 73,000, because of what has been said and found by the court in terms of the conduct. So it's not as a matter of us figuring it out amongst ourselves. It's very clear what that will be, and that we will be putting up cash now to guarantee or risk that being an outcome. So, I mean, I think to me it's more clear than that. I recognize there can be the vagaries involved when we have to decide amongst ourselves on certain issues, but here it's framed up already.
May I add one thing, Commissioner?
Certainly, Mr. Olson.
Just to say that along the lines of an argument that was alluded to, if the Commission were to take a position in litigation that it believed was right, important, and necessary, and it was later sanctioned for it, should the commissioners have to pay the fee?
I don't understand the question exactly, but I don't think this is a time for hypotheticals because we could probably go through a lot of iterations.
Well, it was more a rhetorical question than a... I think the point, though, is that litigation is a messy business, and many arguments can be made one way and the other, and the key question comes back to whether the regs are the regs and the irrespective test is the irrespective test, and that's my final thought.
Mr. Vice Chairman?
Will you entertain a motion?
I just want to, yes. But let me just say one thing before that, and that is I think that it may turn out to be a distinction without a difference, because I don't see how we can say that he can't appeal this using campaign funds. Part of the appeal cost is posting the supersedeas bond, and the judgment will probably come out of that. But so I may be really splitting hairs here, but I don't know what's going to come out at the end of the day or what the judgment will be based on or whether the judgment may go beyond the supersedeas bond. You know, courts can do all sorts of things. So I would feel comfortable with the draft deleting the phrase on the first page and or to pay the final judgment if we just keep it in terms of using the campaign funds to post a cash deposit in lieu of a supersedeas bond. I think subsumed in that is using it to pay his lawyers to do the appeal. If there are legal costs implied, so I'm parsing it very finely here, and it may turn out not to make a difference in the end. But Commissioner Walton,
Madam Chair, I think maybe we should take a look at how that's being framed up, because as I understand it, you would want to have the discretion that the money not be used for that purpose. But the way it's being, I mean, just under the circumstance, he cannot get a bond. It has to be a cash bond. It has to be cash. That's the bond. And so if the case comes down that this is upheld, that money will be used to pay the judgment. There's no discretion at that point. So you can't say, well, we'll wait and see in that regard.
Well, no, my point is that if there's a separate judgment that goes beyond the supersedeas bond. I just, the language is a little bit too broad for me, the way this is written right here. You know, if you stop it at the supersedeas bond, I'd support that. And then whatever happens, happens. Commissioner Hunter,
I'm a little confused. So you're okay with the way it is, but if there's an additional judgment, if there's sort of two judgments, is that what you're saying?
One never knows what courts are going to do.
Okay.
So the court might, you know, there may not be a judgment. The judgment may go the other way, or the judge may, I assume, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume the judge could say, you owe even more money. There could be extra litigation. You know, we're talking about attorney's costs, and presumably attorney's costs continue to mount during the appeal, right? Will that be subsumed within the supersedeas bond?
Honestly, I don't know what the Alaska procedure would be. This gets into a very technical issue. I'm not admitted in Alaska and could not help the commission.
Nor am I.
I just have a question about your proposed edit.
Certainly.
And it's along the lines of Commissioner Walther's comment. Once the bond is posted, it's in the breast of the court.
Mm-hmm.
So if he loses the appeal, the bond can pay the judgment on the order that we are currently aware of. And are you comfortable with that result?
I am, because it's the only way for him to appeal it. You know, I don't feel like that is a ruling on our part about the vexatious conduct. It is, as I understand it, under Alaska procedures, the only way that he can appeal it is to post this bond. And I recognize that the bond may be used to pay the final judgment. But, you know, people look at these opinions in other contexts, and the rules may be slightly different in a different court or in a different jurisdiction. Mr. Noti, did you want to weigh in on this?
Just a technical
matter,
Madam Chair. If that language, the and or to pay the final judgment language, appears multiple places in the draft, it's not just on page one.
I would consider that a technical and conforming amendment.
Okay, well, it may go slightly beyond technical. For example, there's the top paragraph on page 8. Concludes, accordingly, Miller may also use campaign funds to pay the final judgment should he be unsuccessful on appeal. It's unclear whether just striking that sentence would render the rest of the language potentially nonsense.
I guess my concern is clarification for Mr. Olson and Mr. Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And that we capture the spirit of what you intend to occur here, that the supersedious bond could pay the existing order.
Supersedious bond, as far as I'm concerned, will be used for whatever the court considers it appropriate to use it for.
Okay. And so my question is, should we take a recess to see if we can work out some clarifying language to excise the language that you wanted to excise, but to put that clarification in?
A recess is always in order to make sure that we have the language clear. Again, my concern is in part because other people will, in other circumstances, in other jurisdictions, will trot out this AO and say, whether a supersedious bond is required or not, I get to use this money to pay a final judgment, even if I've engaged in bad conduct, and that's what I'm getting the judgment for. Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure that we are not opening up this wider than needs to be under the circumstances.
I think we'd be in agreement if we can just add the clarifying language so that Mr. Olson and Mr. Miller aren't left in any doubt that if they lose the appeal, the supersedious bond can pay the judgment on the order that we are currently aware of, the order that's before the commission at this time. Can we take a recess and work out that language? And then maybe we'll come back and have some consensus.
It's fine with me. Does that sound good? Council prepared to do a little bit of red penciling for us?
We can do that.
Okay, we will take a brief recess. Okay, we are back, and I believe that Mr. Noti, our faithful scribe, has the proposed amendments to the language. Oh, let me just, the Vice Chairman's asked for the opportunity to speak first, so just.
Yes, I just need to disclose that during the break I did have an ex parte discussion with Mr. Olson briefly about the pending advisory opinion.
Okay, Mr. Noti, go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are three amendments. The primary one is on page 8, lines 6 and 7. We would strike the sentence that begins accordingly, including the footnote that follows that sentence, and replace it with the following language. Having posted that deposit, the Commission recognizes that under the relevant court rules, Alaska Dispatch would have the right to apply the deposited funds in satisfaction of the judgment if Miller's appeal were unsuccessful. And then the corresponding changes, the two other corresponding changes would be on page 1, lines 16 to 19, a sentence that begins, "The Commission concludes," would be amended to read, "The Commission concludes that the committee may use campaign funds as discussed herein because the lawsuit would not have existed irrespective of Miller's campaign." And we would make the identical change to the short answer, which is at page 4, lines 11 to 14. And we would ask for authority to make technical and conforming amendments should there be other places in the draft that require.
Thank you, Mr. Noti. I recognize I'm drawing a very fine legal point here, and I'm really more worried about the precedent going forward that might what other people might take from this in other circumstances. I think Mr. Miller is going to end up in more or less the same place that he would have had we not changed the draft. But as I said, I'm sort of worried about what other people might derive from this. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Madam Chairman, at this time I'd make a motion. I move approval of agenda document number 13-41, advisory opinion, 2013-11, Citizens for Joe Miller, with the edits just explained by our counsel, and granting our counsel authority to make technical and conforming edits as may be deemed necessary.
And here we thought you weren't going to start making motions until the next meeting. See, you're catching on quick there, Mr. Vice Chairman. Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-11. Citizens for Joe Miller, with the as set forth in agenda document 13-41, with the amendments described at the table by Mr. Noti, and authorizing counsel to make any technical and conforming changes. Is there any discussion on the motion? In that case, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
Motion carries 5-1 with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter and Peterson, Commissioner Ravel, and myself voting in favor, and Commissioner Walther voting against. Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters we need to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned.